This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
According to the survivors, people were shot while trying to escape and during attempts to recapture them.
That's UN Refugee Agency spokesman William Spindler talking about reports of refugees being killed and injured in Libya. Details next. Also, experts with the World Health Organization say there is a strong chance the Ebola outbreak in the DRC may be contained within weeks. And the United Nations Security Council has voted to extend sanctions on South Sudan for 45 days. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Refugee Agency says more than a dozen Africans who were held captive by human traffickers in Libya have been killed and many others wounded while trying to escape. The UNHCR says the victims were among a group of some 200 Eritrean, Ethiopian and Somali migrants and refugees. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The incident happened last week in Bani Walid, about 180 kilometers southeast of the Libyan capital, Tripoli. UN Refugee Agency spokesman William Spindler says this is just the latest horror story coming out of Libya, where people are being held by human traffickers in horrific conditions and sold into modern-day slavery.
According to the survivors, people were shot while trying to escape and during attempts to recapture them. The survivors spoke of torture, abuse, and exploitation at the hands of traffickers, some being held in captivity for up to 3 years.
Spindler says local Libyan authorities have transferred 140 people who managed to escape to an official detention center. He says UNHCR has been distributing relief items and screening the survivors to identify those in need of international protection. He tells VOA it is more difficult to provide protection for refugees than it is for people classified as economic migrants.
If they are economic migrants and they can return to the country of origin, then IOM helps them to do that. When it's the case of refugees, they can't return to the country of origin, then we need to find a different solution involving third countries.
Spindler says the UNHCR believes it is likely many refugees and migrants who tried to escape may be hiding from the traffickers while others remain in captivity. He says the survivors include a number of unaccompanied children who are particularly vulnerable. He says the UNHCR is trying to find appropriate solutions for them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ebola experts with the World Health Organization are saying there is a strong chance the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo may be contained within weeks. So far, the WHO says there have been 50 confirmed or probable cases with 25 deaths. Dr. Peter Salama, the WHO's head of emergency response, tells VOA's Jackson Mfunganye that responding organizations have been able to use the lessons from past outbreaks to track the disease and overcome some of the logistical challenges they face in the DRC.
In terms of the situation on the ground, we were very concerned about a week ago about the situation in Bandaka, which is the provincial capital of Equator province in northwest Congo. And the reason we were concerned is we had four confirmed cases, and it's a quite a sizable urban center with a population of between 1 and 2 million people. And it happens to lie on the banks of the Congo River, which made us extremely concerned that if a sick person was to travel, they could get potentially to Kinshasa through the Congo River, which is a city of 10 million people, or they could get across the borders into Bangui, the capital of Central African Republic. We were very concerned that that could lead to an Ebola outbreak on the scale of what we saw in West Africa a couple of years ago. So far, we haven't seen that exponential increase in Bandaka, and indeed, there's been no further confirmed cases. And because now we've conducted contact tracing and a vaccination campaign, we're really moving the front line of our response to the two rural epicenters, which are Bikoro and Iboko, where more than 90% of the cases have been confirmed.
Now, Dr. Salama, there have been some in the health community who have gone as far as to compare this outbreak, the current outbreak, to the one in 2014. What is your take on that?
Well, in terms of the outbreak itself, what is in common is, of course, the urban centers were also affected in the West African outbreak. We also had multiple sites of infection, as we do in this outbreak, and health workers were getting infected, which we also have in this outbreak. So there were a few potential risks that could have made this outbreak, yes, very much on a larger scale. Fortunately, the response of the government, of the DRC, has been strong, and so has the response of the UN, led by WHO. So we're hoping that we'll be able to stop this outbreak in its tracks in the coming weeks and months.
So you have confidence that you will be able to contain this outbreak?
I think we're putting collectively our best international foot forward. WHO, for example, has 150 people already on the ground in Equator province, working around the clock to contain the outbreak, to ensure there's adequate supplies, to ensure every contact is traced, to ensure now we're using this new investigational vaccine in the best way possible to stop the ongoing chains of transmission. So, yes, we are confident we can eventually contain this outbreak. The question is how quickly and to get over some of the very difficult logistics. Remember, we're talking about very remote rural villages surrounded by hundreds of kilometers of forested area, no paved roads, and extremely difficult logistics with no power or electricity.
Right. And speaking of logistics, given some of the lessons you learned from previous ones, specifically the recent ones in West Africa, how has the World Health Organization been able to respond differently?
Yeah, well, we've spent a couple of years really reforming the emergency program since that outbreak. And I was brought in specifically to do that reform from another organization. And I think we have put in place the ability to pick up public health threats much more quickly, and then to respond in a very timely and robust manner. And that's the biggest change that we've seen this time round. We've deployed, as I said, more than 150 people within 10 days of this outbreak being confirmed. And we've had tremendous support, I must say, from our partners, whether it's Médecins Sans Frontières, the World Food Programme, UNICEF, or the Red Cross and Red Crescent. We've had a lot of support from partners to make sure everything is extremely well functioning in this response.
That was Dr. Peter Salama, the head of emergency response for the WHO, speaking with our colleague Jackson Mfungadye. The United Nations Security Council has voted to extend sanctions on South Sudan for 45 days. The council is also considering a travel ban and asset freeze on six of the country's leaders if fighting does not end by June 30th. Among those affected would be Defense Minister Kuol Maniang Juka, former Army Chief Paul Malong, and the Governor of Bay State, Kawang Rambang, who is accused of obstructing aid to civilians. The resolution passed with a 9-0 vote, with six abstentions, including Ethiopia, China, and Russia. Ethiopia's UN ambassador, Takeda Alemu, said the move could harm peace negotiations being led by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD. South Sudan's representative ambassador, Akwibon Malawal, says his government is working towards peace and that the threat of individual sanctions was not necessary. But the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, says the Trump administration has lost patience with the status quo and that the international community needs to take action to hold the warring parties accountable. For the past 5 years, South Sudan has been gripped by fighting between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and his former deputy, Riek Machar. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. 15 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The UN Refugee Agency says more than a dozen Africans who were held captive by human traffickers in Libya have been killed and many others wounded while trying to escape. Experts with the World Health Organization say there is a strong chance the Ebola outbreak in the DRC may be contained within weeks. And the United Nations Security Council has voted to extend sanctions on South Sudan for 45 days. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In the Gambia, HIV patients who were exposed to former President Yahya Jammeh's traditional treatment program have filed a lawsuit against the exiled leader. The HIV patients are seeking financial damages from the High Court in Banjul. They also want the court to declare that Jammeh violated their rights. VOA's Pandera Mbai reports.
The lawsuit was filed by three survivors of Yahya Jammeh's HIV-AIDS treatment program, which generated an international outcry among AIDS activists. They are backed by the New York-based international advocacy organization AIDS Free World, in partnership with the Gambian Institute for Human Rights Development in Africa. Saramba Kande is with AIDS Free World.
This case, we hope to bring to the world's attention also the situation of people living with HIV and AIDS in the Gambia. These were vulnerable people who Jammeh took advantage of. It took a long time for them to be recognized as victims, and we want to give them the opportunity to get the justice that they truly deserve through the award of financial damages.
In 2007, Jammeh said he had discovered the cure for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, using bananas and herbs. Patients were confined to one location under heavy military guard, and Jammeh often treated them on live television program. Fatou Jatta is one of those suing Jammeh. She describes the treatment he used.
It was a disaster. Some died during the treatment, some died after discharge. Believe me, I automatically come weak because I was not used to herbal medicine. And during that time, you cannot just leave, because if you leave, it's another problem for you.
Jammeh doesn't believe in Western medication for HIV, including the antiretroviral drugs that have become the standard treatment worldwide, keeping millions of people alive. He barred his patients from taking their ARV drugs. Dr. Tamsin Mo was Jammeh's health minister, and he barred the president's treatment. He noted at the time that Jammeh's family was known for its use of herbal medications. Jammeh's government expelled a United Nations official who criticized the HIV program. The envoy said Jammeh would only give false hope to patients and could cause them to engage in risky behavior that would spread the sexually transmitted disease. Over 20,000 Gambians are said to be living with HIV. Jammeh, who had no formal medical training, also offered fertility treatment for men and women who had trouble conceiving, and he claimed he could cure asthma and diabetes. Saramba Kanda said Jammeh must account for his crimes.
That there would be a day of reckoning if you sit there as a world leader and abuse your people, thinking that you would never be held to account for those abuses.
Mr. Jammeh came to power in July of 1994 through a coup. He ruled the Gambia for 22 years and has been accused of suppressing the opposition and committing numerous human rights abuses. He left office and went into exile last year after a resounding election loss. For VOA Africa, this is Pandera Mbai reporting.
Uganda is imposing a tax on social media use that critics claim is an effort to smother dissent and hinder political organizing while hitting the poor the hardest. The government denies the allegations and says the money is badly needed to bolster funding for education, healthcare, and roads while curtailing gossip. The tax was passed yesterday and will take effect July 1st on services such as Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp. While the cost doesn't sound like much, 200 shillings, which is about 5 US cents, it adds up to about $19 a year in a country with average per capita income of about $615. In addition, a 1% tax is being imposed on mobile money transactions, which are widely used for remittances. There are questions about how the tax can be implemented, given that the government is straining just to make sure all SIM cards are registered. Rwanda has defended its decision to spend $40 million on advertising with British soccer team Arsenal after coming under criticism. The East African nation relies on foreign aid for a significant portion of its budget. Rwanda's tourism authority argues the initiative is part of a larger drive to double visitor revenue. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
When the English Premier League football season kicks off in 2 months, the Arsenal Football Club jerseys will have a Visit Rwanda logo on their sleeves. The three-year deal cost Rwanda about $40 million, sparking criticism of the National Tourism Agency. The East African nation receives $80 million a year in assistance from the United Kingdom. About 17% of Rwanda's budget comes foreign aid. Although government officials say that is down to about 80% 15 years ago. The agency says the Arsenal deal is part of its campaign to double tourism revenue to $800 million a year. Tourism employs more than 100,000 Rwandans. The agreement can be good in the short term, says Kwame Owino, the head of the Institute of Economic Affairs.
$40 million for Rwanda, just like any African country, would be significant sums, but given the calculations they're making about what its yield will be for tourists, I think that is something that can be measured. So a three-year medium-term agreement is a good one, because at the end of it, they may have to evaluate how productive that has been, whether it met its objectives.
Gerishoni Kiara, an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi, says unlike some African countries, Rwanda is not afraid to take risks when it comes to business.
Within East Africa, it is one of the smallest economies, but it liberalized before many others, allowing free entry of goods and services. And the country has been experiencing one of the highest growth rates in the region, when many people just fear that if you open up as an African country and as a small country within East Africa compared with Kenya or Tanzania, that you are making a big mistake. But it has worked very well for Rwanda.
The World Bank says at least 60% of Rwandans live in extreme poverty. The government aims to change that by pushing economic development and moving from a low-income economy to a middle-income one by 2020. Still, Owino says spending millions of dollars in sponsorship deals, while many people go to bed hungry, may worry some people.
In terms of perceptions, it may look like people in the government of Rwanda have their heads in the clouds and they are trying to do posh things when people in their own country may even be lacking basic necessities. So I think that's a big risk. The second risk is that it might not work. I mean, it might not work in the sense that you may pay, but there's no guarantees that it will lead to a yield in tourism, especially whether from English people alone or whether from other parts of the world where people watch Arsenal Football Club.
In 2013, Tanzania signed a sponsorship deal with another English club, Sunderland. According to the Tanzania's Tourism Board, visitors' numbers have doubled, 1.2 million visitors. Rwanda hopes when its Arsenal deal expires in 3 years, the country will have generated similar growth. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Zimbabwe theatre group is hoping to start a dialogue around the 1983 massacres in the country's Matabeleland region. They're planning to present a play looking back at the controversial era, an idea they shelved 6 years ago. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi has details.
The theatre piece is entitled 1983, The Dark Years, by the Chawunda Community Arts, based in Gwanda. The play relives 1983 massacres in Zimbabwe, popularly known as Kukura Hundi. The plot revolves around a girl who cannot get a national ID because she has no parents. She asks her uncle about her late parents who died at the hands of government military wing called the 5th Brigade. It's said to have been behind the massacres. Kukura Wundi is a Shona term for the early rain that washes away the chaff. In the case of massacres, the perpetrators referred to victims as the chaff that needed to be discarded. An estimated 20,000 people in the Matabeleland region were killed at the time. The victims were called dissidents, labeled as opponents of the Mugabe and ZANU-PF rule that was still in its infancy. Adrian Musa is the director of the play. He says that part of history is sensitive.
Where we come from in Matabeleland, the term Kukura Wundi by then, it was a tense word. You know, you could feel fear within the people. So Matabeleland is pregnant with emotions when we want to talk about this subject. And it is a subject which needs attention. We want to try and create a platform of dialoguing so that at least we can find peace.
The play was banned shortly after its premiere in 2012. The ban was lifted with the help of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. Despite the move, Musa says they still had to solve it.
We were victims of the leadership. By then, we were being asked so many questions. Where is this coming from? What is your motivation? Who sent you? So it was difficult for us, even in our living environment. We are a theatre community group. We talk about HIV and AIDS, no problem. We talk about cholera, no problem. But why these particular subjects? So we ended up deciding, let's just pack this one.
Musa says the political landscape has changed and they have decided to resume the play now that there is greater freedom of expression under the new government of Emmerson Mnangagwa. Under Zimbabwe's long-time leader, Robert Mugabe, the Kukura Wundi massacres were considered taboo. Now the subject has resurfaced. There are mixed feelings about discussing it. While some think it's progressive to discuss the killings and search for justice, others say it's not healthy to reopen old wounds. Stabile Malambane is the producer of the play.
Theatre is a mode of communication. On our part as creatives, we're not really for opening old wounds. We just want to create a platform where people get to talk about old wounds, but not necessarily concentrating on the painful part, but on the part when people get to talk about things and understand each other.
A National Peace and Reconciliation Commission has been set up to look into the massacres. Representatives of the commission, the diplomatic corps, and others made up the full house at the play premiere this week. The play is set to show in Harare until the 2nd of June. The commission has been holding meetings around the country, and Malambane says they would be more impactful if their play went around with the commission. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News, coming up 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews?
analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.